welcome to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies, where writers of African American life, culture, arts, and sciences discuss their new books. I'm your host, Vershawn Young, and today I have the opportunity to speak with Boris L. Nunley, the author of Keeping It Hushed, The Barbershop and African American Hush Harbor Rhetoric. If you want to know anything about Black talk, Black discourse, and Black rhetoric, how it's generated, how it applies to Black people, and how it is often understood and sometimes misunderstood when it's directed towards whites, you need to read Boris L. Nunley's book. But before you do, why don't you listen to this interview where he explains a lot about African-American rhetoric.
Hi, Boris.
Hello, Vershawn. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for asking. Today, we're speaking with Boris Nunley, who is professor of English and rhetoric at the University of California, Riverside. And today, we're discussing Nunley's most recent book, Keeping It Hushed, The Barbershop and African-American Hush Harbor Rhetoric, published by Wayne State University Press in 2011. In this book, the Black barbershop becomes a driving trope to discuss other spaces where African-American discourse thrives as a way for Blacks to understand themselves and to theorize Black life and culture. In relation to African-American Hush Harbor rhetoric, Nunley makes a bold claim. He says, if you don't know African-American Hush Harbor rhetoric, then you don't know Black people or their subjectivities or perspectives. I'm happy to have Boris on New Books in African American Studies today so that he can expound on that claim and other insightful provocations that he reveals in his book. Boris, can you begin by telling us a little bit about yourself?
I was born in Southern California, born and raised there, and I'm a product proudly of junior college and public universities. The way I fell into rhetoric is quite interesting because it was incidental. I was originally interested in psychology, but had a love for African-American literature. And I applied to the state program for like the top 5% of students in psychology. And for some odd reason, I wasn't accepted, and I was just befuddled by that. So my mentor, in her sly way, George Johnson, said, well, why don't you apply for literature? And so I just did that on a lark because I just didn't think that what I had been told I'd be able to actually do any teaching in literature, then I'd be relegated to composition. Well, I ended up getting accepted to this program in literature, and I decided, well, if I'm going to be in literature, I should have some skill that I think would be marketable in a variety of different places. So I chose rhetoric and composition, and it just took off from there. So I ended up incidentally falling into something that I really come to really enjoy and love.
Very nice. So you say that you're a product of Southern California. Where were you born exactly?
In Los Angeles. I was born in the mythical South Central Los Angeles that really doesn't exist, but certainly seems to. Yeah, I was born there near the LA Coliseum. So
being a professor at University of California, Riverside, is that like being at home or no?
That's a great question. It's really kind of a liminal space. It's being home in the sense that LA is within an hour's drive, and if you're a Southern Californian, you know, an hour's drive is nothing. It's like walking around the block. Mm-hmm. And so I'm quite able to immerse myself in, you know, African-American culture and the kind of vibe and zeitgeist of Los Angeles. But on the other hand, Riverside might as well be not just 60 miles from L.A., but 120 miles from L.A. It's an exoburb. The politics are very conservative in many ways. It's a mom-and-pop community. So UC Riverside itself ends up being a rather twilight zone in the middle of a kind of conservative utopia. And so it's great that I have such close access to home, and the student body is so diverse in a really kind of fundamental way. And I don't mean just in terms of bodies, I mean in terms of politics. So that's great. But Riverside is a city unto itself, and it's quite disconcerting in some ways, but I'm really glad to be here. It's more, it's
know, I was struck by your book overall. I think it's very well written. I mean, you're an exquisite writer. Your acknowledgments also are extremely well written. And I was wondering if you wanted to say a word about your parents, Doris and Lafayette. You mentioned as an aside right at the opening in the acknowledgments that your mom would have gotten a PhD, had she been born in another era. Can you talk about that a little bit?
You actually did read the book very closely. You got to talk about it. Well, my mom is from a small town in Oklahoma, Yuba, Oklahoma, as a matter of fact. She played high school basketball. And my love for reading and discussion of ideas and contemplating, you know, a philosophy, that sort of thing, really all emerges from her. She's traveled. She discusses politics. Even at 78, we can talk about politics for 4 or 5 hours, movies, that sort of thing. But because she was a Black woman, and I don't have to go into that, that kind of relegated her to certain kinds of positions. But she worked for the County of L.A., and so she has retirement. So she also raised kids. So as many Black women, she really had to kind of straddle two worlds. And she's smart. She's thoughtful. I get my sense of independence and actually a little bit of my ironiness from her. So yeah, she's quite an amazing woman in that way. And again, had she been 20 before, 20 years later, 10 years later, she would have had a PhD and well before I did. And I probably would have been better for it. So yeah, she's really the kind of, I think, the intellectual fulcrum of the family. It's not to diminish my pops, because my father, I think what I get from him is my sense of adventurousness and courage. I mean, he left a small town of Texas, came to California, migrated to California, and started his own business. Was very successful at it. So, I'm one of those people who clearly understands that I didn't do this by myself, and that my ancestors, in this case, my mother and father, made most of this possible for me. So I'm not under any illusions about that.
And yet, you went across the nation to go to grad school. Is that true?
Yes, I did. Well, there you go. Right. I mean, that's Nunley adventurism, the kind of frontier individualism of part of the family that just, I mean, it's part of my kind of culture DNA, I guess. But there were real reasons for doing it. As I said earlier, I knew I wanted to go on rhetoric and composition. And I had this kind of Janus-based relationship to my work, right? I really wanted to do rhetoric and composition, but it was also vitally important to me to do something in African-American culture. And for me, the colleges that did that the best were Hall Bag East, and that meant Penn State, Syracuse, and some others. And then, of course, that meant that's how I got introduced to Keith Gilliard. So that's why I went.
Okay. And of course, that's at, as you mentioned, Penn State, and Keith Gilliard is a professor of English at Penn State.
That's correct. He was at Syracuse at that time, but went to Penn State the year that I arrived there.
Okay. Uh-huh. Now, you mentioned that you wanted to do rhetoric and composition, and one of the interesting things about your book, however, is mm-hmm. that it is very interdisciplinary. As a matter of fact, in the introduction, in which you take pains to lay out beautifully what the theoretical thrust of this project is, before doing so, you say that it's interdisciplinary and traverses critical theory, philosophy, cultural studies, rhetoric, history, popular culture, literature, and religion. So how is it that you came to write such an interdisciplinary book on this topic?
What influenced me in terms of that is Toni Morrison. As anyone who's familiar with literature knows, always deals with issues of Blackness. And like, for example, now there's this discussion about both Blackness and Touré being concerned about there's no one way to be Black. And what always impressed me about Toni Morrison is she didn't have those issues because she was very clear that being black precluded her from nothing that was human. So she could be both black and fully human. And so I always kind of understood that in order to really get a sense of what it was to be African-American or what it is to be black in particular sorts of ways, that meant that I had to have a broad stroke, a broad perspective on how African-American culture circulated and what that meant. So, I mean, can one really understand, again, what it is to be African-American without understanding philosophy, literature, et cetera? You add that to my own kind of intellectual precociousness, so for good or ill, that's why I thought I had to approach it. And that was the most interesting way for me to do it. So methodologically speaking, given my own kind of penchants, and because, again, of Toni Morrison, that's why I wrote the book the way that I did versus trying to do an ethnography.
Mm-hmm. And the barbershop figures largely in the monograph. I mean, you open up with a couple of nice epigraphs. One of them from Ralph Ellison, in which he says, "There is nothing like a Negro barbershop for hearing what Negroes really believe." And then you enlarge on that in the introduction. Can you tell us why the barbershop is so important?
David Delaney, who wrote a book about race and space, talked about the significance of space to what it is to be the ethnicity and what it is to be African American, and even which led me to think about the Middle Passage, right, which arguably one could argue is the kind of crucible of where African American ethnicity was created. In that sense, you have these divergent African ethnic groups in this one space, and then there's some kind of transformation that goes on, and then they land on our shores, et cetera. And so I just, as I was reading throughout my undergraduate and graduate career, it just always struck me how significant space was African-American culture, whether it was the slave quarters, whether it was the juke joint, a ghetto, et cetera, et cetera. And as an African American male, it was just always interesting to me how the barbershop was this kind of protean space for African American discourse of all sorts. It was classed, very unruly in terms of class, even around sexual orientation, et cetera, et cetera. So for me, the barbershop provided me an opportunity to kind of ground my analysis on something that I thought African-Americans would already have a grasp of, whether they're male, female, et cetera. Because, of course, we know the black women would often take their kids there with a beauty shop or a barber shop. So that's why I kind of grounded it there, because I wanted to make this broader claim in terms of African-American hushabber rhetoric, this tradition, or this philosophical tradition, but in order to get access to that, I thought I needed to ground it in a particular space. So that's why the barbershop was so important.
Is African-American hush harbor rhetoric your neologism?
Here I'm going to sound like I'm waffling, but I'm not. Yes and no. And so when I say no, what I mean by that is the term hush harbor is borrowed from African enslaved African Americans or enslaved Africans. When they'd be out in the woods or in a cane break, they would call it a hush harbor or a hush harbor, et cetera, et cetera. And another iteration of that was hush harbor. And so from that, and by the way, I was introduced to that term by Lawrence Levine's Black Culture, Black Consciousness book, which was really my introduction to how to theorize African-American culture in a particular sort of way when I was a second year undergrad. I just noticed how those rhetorics, whether it was literature, movies, et cetera, which again is why it's so interdisciplinary, I just seem to be everywhere. So to me, that meant that I could talk about it as a tradition. So the notion of a hush harbor, the rhetorical tradition is my term. But again, it was certainly borrowed from and heavily influenced by enslaved African Americans. For me, it's perfect, right? Because then it gives this term its own, its history is embodied or immersed in the term, even though I articulate it in my own sort of way.
What exactly is African American hush harbor rhetoric?
Put it very simply, African American hush harbor rhetoric can be understood as the kind of black talk, episteme, or knowledge, philosophies that are grounded in African American worldviews, tropes, and realities. It's what Michael, this was my name right now, but it's what one African American scholar refers to as black life worlds. So African American hush harbor rhetoric emerges out of those black spaces, black life worlds that are within which African American epistemes, worldviews, normals, and again, realities are both constructed and also are emerged from. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. You use the barbershop films from the early turn of the century, both of them, to sort of explain what hush harbor rhetoric is and is not. Can you tell our listeners what it is and is not using those films?
That's a great question. And it's actually something I get to later on when I read. And in terms of how we have to understand, how we can understand Obama's More Perfect Union speech, I think those movies are key. Because one, they occur in a barbershop, so clearly it's about, and in a black, so-called black urban area. So clearly it's a space where black people feel safe. And Cedric the Entertainer, who in my book I argue is a kind of philosopher, even makes that clear because he says at one point, he says, look, y'all, normally I wouldn't say that in front of white sailors, in front of white people, but in front of you, I'm going to say A, B, and C. Later on, for example, which became a kind of both a internet storm and a territorial storm in terms of black culture, when in the movie they critiqued Jesse Jackson. And Cedric the Entertainer responds, you know, very, very pointedly by saying, look, in Hush Harbor, we can talk about anyone, anytime and anywhere we want, because if we can't do it here, and to me this is vitally important, we can't do it anywhere. So here you have, in this really kind of pithy comedy, a real kind of understanding of how the public sphere isn't this kind of free zone, rhetorical free zone, that in actuality it's going to be very dangerous for African Americans. So I think in terms of it being hush harbor rhetoric, that is a very productive way to a very productive way in which it engaged in the rhetoric and the tradition. The problem is that the way it engaged in its talk was in ways to make it comfortable for white audiences. So, for example, a really kind of interesting point in the movie is when Cedric the Entertainer says, well, there's three things that black people need to stop lying about. And he talks about OJ, right? And he talks about, and he goes through this kind of litany. Well, in hush harbors, we don't talk about just what black people lie about. We talk about what white people lie about.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been a perfect opportunity to do that. And, of course, yes, we understand that white folks are not a monolith, et cetera, but white folks and white people is hegemonic. And so for the film to not do that, right, and to really kind of address black issues in a way that most white people would say, oh, yeah, well, that's right, that would make them feel comfortable, is exactly why I think they were able to make another movie, because it really didn't challenge their sense of a privilege. And so for me, it is both it's a hush harbor film in terms of its form and in its style, and in its politics in terms of its ability to go beyond a domesticated kind of blackness. But it's not a hush harbor film in the sense that if I'm white, I can leave there and I don't feel comfortable at all, right? So that's why for me it doesn't qualify for that. It makes me think of the film that Queen Latifah was in, Beauty Shop, which was a cousin to the Barbershop film, but for me, it didn't ring as a Hush Harbor film because I'm an African-American man. I'm watching this film about black women, and I'm walking out the film, and I'm feeling happy and cheerful. And it's like, I should walk out of that film kind of like, well, what the hell are they talking about? Having my political buttons pushed, none of that really happened. So that's why I think what you've asked is a really pertinent question, because one has to be kind of clear that while there is, while black folks are not monolithic, neither are whites, there are these kind of political rationalities that discipline into place what is seen as acceptable speech and unacceptable speech.
So can you give us a popular culture example of African-American Hush Harbor rhetoric? Would Sam Greenlee's Spook Who Sat by the Door be an example? Would you consider Invisible Man an example?
I would consider Greenlee's piece to certainly be Hush Harbor in a particular sort of way, so no doubt about that. Invisible Man is a little more ambivalent in that sense, because certainly he addresses issues of that black folks and black knowledges are really, really grounded in, right? So, for example, this notion of capital paint, where the white is white because it has a drop of black paint, right? Or you have I am what I am. And so this kind of existential notion of the importance of the yam. So all that is certainly about black culture. But on the other hand, at the end of the novel, he does end up in an underground cave, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, and he is invisible in a certain kind of way. So not to take anything away from Ellison, because obviously I quoted him pretty in my book, and it influences what I do. But I think it's telling that the second book, when he actually had to get out of the cavern, as it were, out of Plato's cave and be in the world, that book never got written. And I would argue that part of that is to bring into the world this kind of Hush Harbor blackness is another thing than when you end up in a cave. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. In your introduction, you refer to Kanye West. And I it struck me that as I was reading through the book that one example of publicizing African American Hush Harbor rhetoric could be when Kanye West said during the aftermath of the Hurricane Katrina disaster that President Bush does not like black people or doesn't care about black people.
Well, you're interviewing me, so I'm not supposed to like pontificate, but actually, you're exactly right. you're exactly right. There's nothing else to be said. And I would argue, as you know, in my book, I would argue that another moment of that would be the very first episode of Boondocks, in terms of that first scene in the so called riot and the kind of bucolic white area, and the boy wakes up. You hear the slap, and Huey wakes up, and his father said, "You have that dream," where his grandfather said, "You're having that dream again, where you tell white folks the truth." Well, you better not ever tell white folks the truth. I'm about to go lie to a white man right now. And what's interesting is when I show that clip to white audiences, they get it, and they laugh. But of course, one of the reasons why they can get it and laugh, because it's an animated feature, so it allows them to take it in ways that they wouldn't take it if maybe if I were on the stage and I said that. So you're exactly right.
But now I want to move into a series of questions in which I want to challenge, not contradict or challenge some of the things you've said, but there's some touchy points in here that I want to get to. But first, before that, I want you to be able to speak to a moment where you begin to lay out the theoretical foundation for this book. And you make a beautiful statement, I think. You say sometimes it's as if Patricia Hill Collins, the sociologist that does race, class, and gender and sexuality, and Geneva Smitherman, you know, the mother icon of black language studies and sociolinguistics, you said it's almost as if they have never written seriously about African-American language. And that we have to sort of always reclaim or refront those ideas. And so then you do lay out yours. You want to speak to that?
To be frank, I look at it as a kind of epistemological and philosophical erasure. In other words, what Black folks have to say about Black people, that gets taken up in the literature and in the academic imaginary in a way that there is actually a history, and one has to continually refer to it in order to be legitimate. But seemingly, when you have Black folks, like the two women, like Dr. Smitherman Hill and others, that it's almost as if we're not writing about ourselves or about difference, then it has no theoretical or epistemic purchase. So, for example, I'm always kind of amazed that when folks talk to me about my book, and in this case, particularly white folks, there's always this emphasis on the barber shop, but there's not a lot of talk about the theory, right? Because what I said about Hush Harbors as a theory or as a method can be applied in discussions that have nothing to do with African Americans. I mean, there are gay bars, right? There are places and spaces that women go, that folks who identify as queer go, that this is very, very much part of that theory. But it doesn't get taken up in that way. And I think that happens to Black scholars, African American scholars, scholars of color. It happens all the time. So I remember seeing Michael Eric Dyson one time, and everyone was clapping, and I went and asked several of my colleagues what they thought about what he had to say, right? And this is reminiscent of what we heard around Obama in his public speeches. And every person, they were all professors, said to a word how great his performance was. But they said nothing about him in terms of his theory or the creation of knowledge. So I'll let us just say that I have this little pithy way of going about this, where I say, well, don't you know that Black folks and Black women and people of color, y'all don't know nothing? And of course, that seems to be very provocative. But when I break it down to say that actuality, well, look, how do you legitimize yourself in the academy? And you and both of us attend conferences and all the time. It's right, just like you have to refer to someone who is French or German, mm-hmm, or whatever. And look, I don't have to understand, I don't need to know anything about Foucault to understand the prison industrial complex. I don't. Right? But it just seems like very frequently that folks of color get disappeared in that sort of way in terms of actually being sites, genitive sites that produce theory, et cetera. So that's what I'm getting to when I say that.
Yes, thank you for that. I appreciate that. Okay, so it seemed to me from reading the book that African-American spaces where African-American Hush Harbor rhetoric generates are spaces where Black people could speak openly and freely in ways that would not bring censure from white spectatorship or white audiences. Is that fair to say?
Yes, but with one, I want to push it against the little. It's not that it wouldn't bring censor. It's just that they're in these spaces that white folks do not monitor as closely, and therefore Black folks feel more safe in those spaces. And the reason why it's not mere academic pettiness. There's a space here in Los Angeles called Zambezi Square, or Congo Square, which is a Black space. And there's an African American woman who owns a card shop there. Now, here you have a Black space within a Black space. But one time she said to me that if a white person enters into that space, then the whole tenure of the conversation changes. It's like bell hooks theorized, but their presence changes the shape of our words. So it's not merely that this kind of talk can go on. It's that white folks don't tend to surveil it or monitor it in the same sort of way. So that's the only kind of pressure I put on it. But otherwise, I agree.
Okay. So how then do we understand the irony of moments in films like Barbershop? How do we understand the irony in the Boondocks episode, where clearly white audiences are consuming what either is or is fronted as being Hush Harbor rhetoric?
I think there is an irony there, and I think that your question is one that must always be kind of kept on the table, right? Because we do want to have some kind of nuance. I do want to have some kind of nuance to what I'm saying. But it's really not ironic, right? Because we know from the Mystery Shows forward, some would argue that indeed the American popular culture is really African-American culture, or less provocatively, that American popular culture is grounded in so many ways in terms of how it took place transnationally in black popular culture. So blackness has always been a commodity to be sold. So therefore, white folks will consume black culture in a movie, in any kind of cultural production. However, to occupy the spaces where those knowledges emerge from, well, that's different, because then your body has to be at risk. So it's one thing to be at home watching this sort of thing. It's another thing to be in a theater, but it's another thing to be in a black barbershop, and you and I understand that for all its issues, both good or ill, it's that this embodiment of it is a whole different kind of notion. So there really is no contradiction as far as I'm concerned, and I think even more importantly, and again, I think folks who've been in barbershops and beauty shops understand that these knowledges aren't stagnant. So by the time this stuff gets produced out for public consumption, there folks in those hush harbors are concerned with other spaces, with other issues and other conversations. So it's not a stagnant, stale, petrified sort of place. So because you have this back and forth, this kind of space that is both, as Williams would say, has an emergence tradition, right? And a tradition that's already a residual tradition, or one that's already there. That's why you can, on one hand, have this kind of public consumption by whites, but without the political danger that it means to really occupy those spaces on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to skip around a little bit. Listeners who may not have read the book yet may not know that I'm skipping around, but there are certain chapters in the book in which you deal with, again, the way in which the barbershop is figured in certain cultural products like Von Elder's Ceremonies and Dark Old Men. Again, you revisit Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, but you also talk about some contemporary phenomena, such as Barack Obama's race speech that you mentioned at the outset, and the moment that spawned that speech, which was the conflict that the media created between his rhetoric and Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Can you talk about African-American hush harbor rhetoric in terms of white and black spectatorship or consumership of that rhetoric in relationship to that controversy?
Now, you know I'm gonna like you now, because that's a real great question, and I actually have to think about this. So give me a second. But it's really a relevant question, right?
Let me throw something else out there.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm not gonna complicate the question, but I'm gonna try to tell you a little bit what I'm thinking about.
Okay,
you have beautiful terms that you introduce. You talk about the podium auction block rhetoric or position, I would say, that sometimes African Americans occupy in order to gain, or I say gain, a white audience. That's the way I perceived it, or at least to get a white ear or hearing from whites that won't turn them away. And you mentioned this in relationship to Obama's race speech and in juxtaposition to Jeremiah Wright's rhetoric, the way it was cast. Because we're in an election year, because so many people who support Barack Obama hear him, some people say differently, whites hear him differently from the way blacks hear him. I just wondered if you could, you know, speak to that.
Yeah, that helps a lot. So I think the way to begin would be to take up Jeremiah Wright and the Obama kind of controversy. I think, first of all, what I want to foreground is that this is not some notion of one selling out and the other not selling out. I just think that's too reductive. It's not very productive in trying to understand the phenomena that you're kind of pushing me on, and rightfully so. You had Jeremiah Wright, who had given over 800 speeches, but the furor around his rhetoric was basically around two speeches that he gave at Trinity Baptist Church. Now, Trinity Baptist Church is a hush harbor church. Yes, you have some whites who would go there, but the audience was primarily black, primarily African-American folks, and knowledges were deployed there, and certainly black perspectives, black humor, black ways of knowing were circulated there. And so there's this furor in the public. And let's face it, while there were black folks who didn't agree with Jeremiah Wright, most African Americans, I would argue, would say, I understand where it's coming from. Many whites were just basically unsettled and referred to him as a hate monger, et cetera, et cetera, and just were really unsettled by the talk. So now what happens is, and this is where it gets sticky. From David Walker, Mariah Stewart, to Frederick Douglass, to Martin Luther King, Ella Baker, et cetera, black folks who try to get some public hearing always have understood that you speak differently in front of white folks than you do in front of black folks, period. Now, we in academia, we like to play the fluidity card, and that's fine. But out there in the political world, there are consequences for certain kinds of speeches. And there are certain tropes and commonplaces, right, that one must engage in when they want to get a public hearing. So, Jeremiah Wright's speech, his hush harbor rhetoric, his parousia, his plain speaking truth of power, he was able to do that because he made these speeches in front of an audience that was grounded in hush harbor rhetoric. Obama, however, was concerned not with just black folks, but with the weak, right? And so, therefore, when he begins the perfect union speech, he talks about, for example, he begins with a notion of American exceptionalism, the shiny city on the hill, right? The same kind of tropes that, by the way, Ronald Reagan and George Bush and Pericles, there's this history of that kind of talk. And when you engage in those tropes, white folks, not out of some necessarily prejudice or kind of hegemony, but they sit in the culture and they resonate, and therefore it gives them an in. Secondly, it works for black folks and white folks, I would argue, is because when Obama says we, and this is where I think he's brilliant, and I'm actually down with him, when he says we, unlike many white politicians who, when they get in public office, say we, but we all know they don't mean everyone. They don't mean black folks. They don't mean lesbians. They don't mean queers. They don't mean a whole bunch of other folks. When Obama says we, forget it here, we all think that he means we. It doesn't mean, for example, that he's going to have a policy that is going to necessarily be to the benefit of all black people, but we know, we feel that he's not out to get us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in terms of white and black dictatorship, and I think that you're alluding to, this is where African Americans can become complicit, because I've heard it said time and time again that, well, in terms of Obama's reticence to speak about race, well, he's the brother shouldn't have to speak about race, because if he doesn't, he won't get the white vote. So it's a kind of black pragmatism. But I get that. But my problem with that is it's twofold. The dismissal of the Reverend Wright, right, as a matter of fact, in the more perfect union speech, Obama talks about how he won't totally get rid of or dismiss Jeremiah Wright because he's so important to him. But on the other hand, he talks about black anger as being part of another era. And that, and this is key, he says in this speech, Obama, that racism isn't central to the American project. And to think otherwise is office to be almost crazy. Well, look, African Americans, as I've already said, are not monolithic. But I don't think I have to go on a limb to say most African Americans understand that racism is central to the American project. It's not epiphenomenal to it. So when Jeremiah Wright says this, he's on African American, on firm African American epistemic ground. So my problem with this easy dismissal of Jeremiah Wright and this notion of black pragmatism is this. It's just a pedagogical model, public pedagogy. So in the future, when a white politician runs and he says, or she says, well, you know what? I'm not going to talk about black issues, because if it does, it costs me black votes, or it costs me white votes, then black folks have no claim to say anything against that. We don't have any grounds to resist that, because we've already argued this triple pragmatism.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of black spectatorship, this is what I see as being an issue. So in other words, are we trying to say pedagogically that if a brother or sister is trying to get on, then don't play or hate, engage in the kind of domesticated rhetoric that doesn't talk about race? Because if that's what we're saying, then I see that to be problematic. And so now I think you can see my take on Obama and Wright is not to dismiss President Obama or dismiss his pragmatism, but as a rhetorician, we're always concerned with effect, not concerned with effect. And this takes us back to Kanye West. See, what Kanye West is really hip about, Taylor Swift aside, is that neoliberalism is affecting how we think about blackness. Blackness is being disarticulated from the political and being made into a commodity. So when he sings and all falls down, right, that he can't even go into a grocery store without one of his watches, here he understands that blackness is more increasingly being connected to consumerism and being domesticated instead of being articulated to the political. And what I'm saying in terms of black spectatorship is there is this increasing tendency to reduce blackness to a style, to reduce it to consumption. And so a brother can't play or hate, which means you can't be critical, which means whatever's going on is cool as long as buses can make money from it, et cetera, et cetera. So that's why I think this Obama-Wright discussion is so vitally important.
What's wrong with the commodification of blackness? What's the problem?
The problem with it is, and I hear under your question, well, I want to kind of escalate for your question. It's inevitable in some ways. What I'm getting to in terms of the problem is that then what you can do is have black folk who make appeal to political tropes, like is that black community, right? Or I'm speaking for black people, and actually in their practices, risking nothing in order to do that. So it's what I call blackness without obligation. So they can benefit personally from black oppression, but actually in their behavior and in their practices, they don't have to be committed to it in any way other than what serves them. And an example of that would be, there are like several examples, the selling of BET, the selling of Essence Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stick with that. You have Essence Magazine. We all know that that's a black magazine that made its bones, as it were, became popular, as it were, because how we dealt with black issues. It's up for sale. I have no problem with that. You can sell it to whomever you want. But when it was sold, the sellers of Essence Magazine, who I believe are actually black men, actually said, and this was in the paper, that, well, why can't they act like white people, like white businessmen? Well, if that's the case, then what's all this other history? It's black as a commodity. When it makes you money, then you're black. But when it's going to cost you something, then all of a sudden you become American. Then you're going to be able to act like anyone else. And see, that's the problem with the commodified notion of blackness, that it's blackness without obligation. And this is the problem I have with someone like Toure, who has totally taken this notion of post-blackness and taken it places where it wasn't intended.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you have a guy, and I think you can help me with this. Who wrote the book? Oh, Randall Kennedy wrote the book about Touré and post-blackness, essentially said, well, Touré's problem is that he's married to someone who's not black and he's trying to simplify his lifestyle, which I think is totally correct. You can marry whoever you want, but the notion that somehow black people really think there's only one way to be black, which black person thinks that? I've never met a black person who ever even thought that. So it's really a straw man. You throw up this singular notion of blackness so you can argue against it. So therefore, you can do whatever you want. And if you can do whatever you want, then what does blackness mean?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, there is the problem.
I'm going to just hang on to the this latter chapter that we've been talking about between that takes up the controversy, Obama-Wright controversy, just for a moment, another moment. And ask you to think about something that you didn't address in this chapter, but that is featured in that speech. It's a image that Obama evokes that he ends his speech with about Ashley, a white woman who's about 22 or 23, and one of she's a campaign manager. There's a black man, nameless, and the black man says, Obama recalls or retells the story, that he's in that room because of Ashley.
Right.
Now, the reason why I raise that here and that image stays in my mind is because to me that's the most problematic image that Obama could ever have uttered, and that does so much work for easing white consciousnesses, because you have this figure of a sort of emasculated black man in his elderliness,
mm-hmm.
and also a kind of non-agency in his namelessness, and he gives over any power, any idea, or any rhetoric, I should say. He gives over this entire speech act to the 22-year-old still adolescent white female.
Mm-hmm.
Just wonder if you have any perspective on that in terms of the rhetorical situation or the rhetorical import of that.
Rashad, I think you're dead on. And when I write about that, again, I'm going to say exactly what you said and not give you any credit. I think you're exactly right on. And so let me use that to make another point. Part of that image in terms of its effect is problematic, because what it does is it participates in what I think about in terms of neoliberalism or black neoliberalism. And of course, when I talk about neoliberalism, I don't mean liberalism in terms of Democrats, Republicans. I mean this primary economic, social, and even religious paradigm where social relations, religious relations, and political relations get reduced to the ethos of the market, right? So it's not about politics, it's about the market. And part of that market rhetoric is about privatization. So let's go back to what you just pointed out. And this is what the problem is for me and why his speech was able to do the work it did. He takes Ashley and talks about Ashley's issues, and he takes this black man's history, and he erases it, basically, and compares her experiences to his experiences and his history. And earlier in the speech, he makes this kind of move on different occasions where he will talk about, like, say, affirmative action. So you have black history where black folks have been whipped, murdered, et cetera. This is historical fact. And then he compares that to white folks who, in his words, feel like affirmative action has been working against them, as if affirmative action has circumscribed their life chances. Well, reasonable people can agree or disagree about that. Actually, I don't believe that, but let's just say it anyway. But the problem with that is notice what's happened here. He has removed history and privatized racial discussion to my personal experience, your personal experience, and therefore it's a wash. So Obama can get the level of black folks because he actually is brave enough to talk about black anger, brave enough to talk about black historical oppression, but on the other hand, flips the script and then compares white feelings with no history of that in terms of the history of analysis. And that's the privatization of black, of race talk, of black experience, of racism. And I mean, for me, finally, the proof of that is, look at what happened when Louis Gates found out, we discovered he was black, and that police officer jammed him up, right? And so at first Obama said it was stupid. There's this fear of response to that. And then what ends up happening? Obama says to the police officer and to Henry Louis Gates, let's go have a beer. To me, that's the privatization of racial discussion. So they can discuss it there. They're on equal ground, equal footing, and history gets erased and made into the personal. And that's what neoliberalism does. It takes the political, depoliticizes it, and makes it personal. So I think you're dead on about that Ashley image. And you're right. It may be even more significant than I wrote about, than what I chose to write about, So, I think you're dead on with that.
And let me tell you something else that I take from your book and that I want to take into my classrooms, and also into my own work, because your book has definitely influenced me in so many ways, is this. You just raised this point about how when Gates was arrested, Henry Louis Gates was arrested, and there was some fear over that, but it was mostly from black people. Now, there were some white liberals who were concerned about it, and I can point to Stanley Fish, who wrote an article in the New York Times about it. Yeah, but it was a mild sort of fury. They were concerned, but in terms of like expressing the fury, it was not as expressive as black people's.
I agree. Mm-hmm.
However, action got taken when white people expressed fury over Obama's statement by saying that it was a stupid act. Now, that to me shows a kind of disparity in American society that privileges white anger, white fury, white concerns, and consistently diminishes black oppression and black experience that is negative in relationship to white culture. And so for me, the power that comes through from your book when you talk about these episodes and you bring attention to African American experience as it is discussed in Hush Harbor Rhetoric is to say we need to listen to Hush Harbor Rhetoric, even though it is Hush Harbor Rhetoric, meaning it takes place sometimes in what I'm going to call privatized spaces or black spaces, but that white people need to pay attention to that. And let me say why I'm saying this, what I'm deriving from your book. As rhetoricians and as a rhetorical theorist, you spend a lot of time talking about speech acts, right? Rhetoric and this public performance. However, when you begin with a statement by Ralph Ellison that says you need to listen, I'm sorry, let me be more specific. You quote the Invisible Man in when the Invisible Man is talking to the Marxist brother, and he tells him that if you want to know something, you need to listen to black people. You go into that barbershop and you will hear these things. And you later in the book, you talk about Frederick Douglass. Now, in Frederick Douglass's his narrative, he tells the white abolitionists if they really want to know about slavery, they need to climb into a tree or hide themselves behind a bush and listen to the slave songs on when they're getting ready to go get their pay. You think it's a happy moment, but it's full of pathos, and you understand exactly what it means to be a slave. Otherwise, no amount of abolitionist texts, pamphlets, whatever will give you that insight. Okay, that is an act of listening. And so what is it that your theory, your theoretical framework helps America, white America and black America, to do and know about the act of listening and its and what it can do to, I guess, change the world?
I'm very clear about what I wanted to do. So here I'm going to engage some academic parsing. I'm very clear about what I wanted to do, but by giving, I'm going to borrow from Judith Haberson's, Jack Haberson's latest book, and the notion of the queer art of failure. I wrote this book knowing that it would be a failure. And this is addressing your question. Because it is not, in terms of listening, John Cruise, in his book Culture on the Margin, says he analyzes what he considers to be three kinds of hearing. One would be incidental, the other would be instrumental, and the final would be pathos. What white folks typically do is engage in, and some blacks, but what white folks typically do is a kind of hegemonic block, of course. They engage in what he refers to as instrumental. In other words, you hear what black folks say. You hear what they utter in terms of speech acts. But what ends up occurring is that you use it to your own purposes. Ergo, when you made reference to the Fuhrer and that it didn't become one in a kind of national way until white folks became angry at Obama, that's what instrumental hearing is to take black epistemes, black realities, right? And this is a discussion about the nature of reality, and that people don't want to get to that, and use it to white interest. But there's another kind of listening, which is much more difficult to engage in, is pathos hearing, which, according to Cruz, is about listening and making the attempt not to hear it through your perceptions. Right, to the extent that anyone can do that, but to try to, in some way, take up the assumptions that the speaker, that the rhetorician, that the group that is speaking, take up their assumptions and take them seriously, instead of dismissing them as being merely angry, as being merely radical. And those terms are a way to, one, not listen, right, through deflection, and two, to dehumanize. Now, when I say that, I'm not being provocative. Let me put it this way. Imagine you're in a feminist a class framed in feminist theory. And your notion would be to tell women that in order to be a feminist, you can't be angry. Well, excuse me, being angry is central to what it is to be a human being. It doesn't mean that it drives everything that you do, but we would not tell anyone that they can't be angry because they're domesticating what it means to be fully human. To wit, black people get mad, i.e., the brother on Oakland, Oscar Grant, I believe his name, he gets angry, he gets shot. Black people get angry, they get a tea party. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So when I talk about listening, it is not some kind of liberal sentimentality. And this is why I foregrounded this by saying, in terms of the core art of failure, this is a black art of failure. Because what I really want people to do when I talk about listening is to say that, look, black culture is not only a site to be theorized upon, that black culture is in and of itself theoretical material.
Right.
It theorizes. And what I'm arguing is, that's why I said earlier when I go to my classes, and I said, don't you know that people of color don't know nothing? So let me say it in terms of this conversation. In the public sphere, black folks, black women, queer folks, we don't know nothing. Why? Because the only time they come to us for expertise, generally, is when it has something to do with difference, mm-hmm. and has to do with our oppression. But when For example, you and I both know that the folks we hang out with, yourself included, you can do your work the way you do it and not make any reference to black folks, and your career would pretty much be the same as it is in certain kinds of ways. In other words, what I'm saying here is to legitimate yourself in your career in terms of productivity, et cetera, et cetera, you don't have to grab it in black people.
Mm-hmm.
But black scholars, we cannot be legitimate if we don't know something about some kind of white theory.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So even in my talk here, notice what I've done, and this is why I do it. It's not to kind of try to legitimate black culture and black theory, because it doesn't require it. But what I'm simply saying is, even I could refer to Foucault. I could refer to a number of people. You could do it. Keith could do it. Jackie Jones Royster could do it, because we have to. But white scholars, if they want to take it upon themselves to do it, but they don't have to ground themselves, because it's, again, black theory, black theorists, and the kind of work we do isn't taken seriously in that sort of way. So that takes us back to, again, what your question about listening. And for me, if you don't understand that about, if you don't take that as an assumption, then you don't see black people as fully human, which is why in my book you hear me dealing with ontology and philosophy, because I think a Hush Harbor project, a project around, excuse me, I think Geneva Smithers' project is not just about black culture, it is a theoretical, philosophical project.
So, you, in the book, you take up and enlarge a conversation by Cornel West on the rhetorical principle of paideia.
Yeah.
Could you speak to that to the listeners and what the project of paideia is for you in relation to what you theorize in your book?
The paideia is this this term borrowed from so-called classical traditional Greek rhetoric, was essentially understanding a particular site as sites of education, right? As sites of pedagogy. And what I'm simply trying to argue in my book or in my practice is that there are black ideas, right? But black folks are taught how to survive. Well, black theory is inculcated and practiced. When I say theory, I mean it in the sense, as I do philosophy, borrowing from Gramsci. We're all philosophers, it's just that some of us get paid for it.
Mm.
So we have to understand that black folks theorize. And there are places from which we get those theories. And those places aren't just classrooms. The education, the pedagogy, occurs in a variety of spaces and a variety of sites of what I call public pedagogy.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why this project around paideia is vitally important, because frankly, you know this even better than I, given your work around performativity and how you go outside the academic spaces and places, that most of our students, they come to us in a kind of instrumental way. In other words, they come to college to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
The values that they learn, the way they think about and theorize through the world, they get that from a variety of different sites. And frankly, I think the fundamentalist right, the religious right, they're far more attuned and sophisticated about that than people who are left of center. So what I'm trying to argue here is that we need to understand that there are these black cadets in a variety of different places that teach, that theorize. I'll give you an example. Isn't it interesting that in hip-hop or rap music, you have these entertainers who used to go around, you know, sagging pants, et cetera, et cetera. All of a sudden now, you get cats sporting suits, right, sporting more classic kinds of styles. Well, that just didn't happen out of anywhere, because Jay-Z started sporting his gear like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's actually teaching folks, teaching our children, teaching people ways to be in the world. So for me, we need to take that example and say, okay, there's public pedagogy, they're back to theirs. We need to take those spaces seriously as a project and understand what they do in the world. And that's what I think Wes was trying to get at. That's certainly what I'm trying to get at.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything more that you want to say about your book that we haven't covered in the Q&A?
Actually, no. I mean, I was going to read something, but I think we've covered that. I mean, I can read a paragraph too if you'd like.
Would you please? That's a normal feature, and you know, you're so engaging. You're so engaging, and that I just enjoyed this conversation and listening to you. But it's a normal feature for authors to read a passage, and I would welcome if you would end our interview with a reading.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. This is from the last chapter of the book, Husserl Rhetoric and Rationalities in a Neoliberal Age. A watershed moment that will undoubtedly go down in history as pivotal in the discussion of race in the political public sphere, Senator Obama's A More Perfect Union, otherwise known as his race speech, a form whose tropes are etched into the American imaginary as a shining city on the hill, American exceptionalism. A More Perfect Union was presented in a context in which there was a robust discussion, particularly in Black hush harbors, of whether then Senator Obama's campaign discussed race enough as it relates to African Americans. While he strategically presented race in speeches in front of primarily African American audiences in hush harbor spaces, and then with a heavy dose of self-help discourse, as he did with his speech in South Carolina, Senator Obama generally avoided the topic. And let me pause here to say, he normally doesn't give that self-help talk to white audiences. That's why I could refer to it as his speech as a podium rhetoric, public podium rhetoric rather than hush-hush rhetoric. Returning to the text, of course, the rhetorical tension President-elect Obama had to traverse is obvious. A presidential candidate cannot win the office solely on the strength of African-American votes. As a result, Senator Obama, like Frederick Douglass before him, had to direct his rhetoric to at least two audiences, one Black, other white, in addition to others. Unlike African-American hush-hush rhetoric, where the rhetorical goal of the rhetoric is to identify with a primarily Black audience, their desires, and their political rationalities, podium Ossenbach rhetoric attempts to identify with at least the two audiences I mentioned earlier. A More Perfect Union, then, effectively appeals to the concerns, fears, and desires of those invested in the hegemony of dominant American rationality, white folks, and those of African Americans, preceding, during, and after their enslavement, that body of public display have to at least implicitly consider the spectacle of Blackness, which you referred to earlier, the expectations, fetish, fear of desire and need for the Black body to signify a particular way in the American imaginary, right? So, how did President Obama accomplish this? First, he seamlessly connected the American Democratic Project to his quest for the presidency, and then both to a social theological movement toward a more inclusive American imaginary, an imaginary that for the first time can be read as implicitly including African Americans. Quote, this is one of the tasks we set forth at the beginning of this campaign to continue the long march of those who came before us, a march for a more just, more equal, more free, more caring, and more prosperous America. I choose to run for the presidency at this moment in history because I believe deeply that we cannot solve the challenges of our time unless we solve them together, unless we perfect our union by understanding that we may have different stories, we may hold common hopes, that we may look the same, we may not even have come from the same place, but we all want to move in the same direction, right? Towards a better future for the children and our grandchildren. And now we have two more paragraphs and I'll be finished. Next, President Obama's speech moves from the public podium, Ossenbach rhetoric, to the recognition of hush harbor speciality, its rhetoric, and its utility. Such a move surely forges a connection with African Americans. And while he did not refer to Reverend Wright's church as a hush harbor, President Obama's description of Trinity affirms it as a Black hush-hush speciality. making visible and spoken what often remains masked and blocked. President Obama understood the significance of African-American hush harbor and African-American hush harbor rhetoric and their function as tropes of blackness. Excuse me. In conclusion, like other predominantly black churches, and I'm quoting here, across the country, Trinity embodies the black community in its entirety. The doctor, the welfare mom, the model steward, student, and the former gangbanger. Like other black churches, Trinity services are full of raucous laughter and domestic body humor. They are full of dancing, clapping, screaming, and shouting that may seem jarring to the untrained ear. The church contains and for the kindness and cruelty, the fierce intelligence and the shocking ignorance, the struggles and successes that love and, yes, the bitterness and bias that makes up black experience in America. So for me, that resounds wonderfully because it brings to mind Duke Ellington, who talks about blackness in dissonance and hush harbors, as Obama describes them, are sites of dissonance. But that's great, right? Because if it's dissonant and unruly, that means it contains possibilities for transformation and change. And for me, that's what hush harbor theory, hush harbor rhetoric, and barbershops and beauty shops are all about.
Boris Nunley, thank you so much for spending an hour of your time with the New Books Network to discuss Keeping It Hushed, the Barbershop, and African-American Hush Harbor Rhetoric.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very, very appreciative. Thank you very much.
We've been listening to Boris L. Nunley talk about his provocative new book, Keeping It Hushed, The Barbershop and African-American Hush Harbor Rhetoric, published by Wayne State University Press in 2011. If you haven't done so already, go out and get your copy.